This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today, we're going to take a look at another John Logan movie, Skyfall.
Yes. Let the sky fall.
Yes. But before we get into that, let's talk about a little bit of news and a few other things in terms of Star Trek creators out in the wild. Okay, so there's a movie coming out called Lucky, and I was lucky enough to see it over the weekend because it was playing at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, and this movie was produced by Ira Stephen Baer, and it stars Harry Dean Stanton and a bunch of other people, but Harry Dean Stanton is definitely the lead. He's the title character, and the story follows him. And it's about a guy, a 90-year-old atheist, who's basically coming to terms with the fact that he's gonna die. Not that he's not like dying, you know, but he's 90 years old. Like the end is near, you know, one way or another. And you know, he's going through that existential dread that I think all atheists go through, where they, you know, sort of come to the realization that when they're dead, that's it, right? And he's kind of, you know, freaking out about it. And the whole story is just about his, you know, sort of like personal journey, you know, figuring this out.
Interesting.
In this small Arizona town where, you know, he's got his routine, you know, he's got the people at the diner that he hangs out with, you know, the people at the bar that he hangs out with and all that stuff. And I know describing that, it sounds terrible, right? I mean,
no, actually, like, it sounds very, very interesting. It sounds like it would be a very interesting perspective. The one thing I would offer is that everybody has that existential dread,
well,
even
sure,
if they are,
sure,
you know, people of faith, because they realize that it's still a gamble.
Sure. Okay. So, all right. You know, I mean, you know, there's definitely a different, you know, I think side to it. Like, for example, there's this sort of running thing with my mom where she constantly is telling me that she can't wait until I die so that when I get up to heaven, she can say, I told you so. You know,
that is predicated on two very disturbing things. One, my mother never said to me, I can't wait until you die. Mm-hmm. She probably thought it on occasion. But I can also say that if you're getting in the door of heaven, a lot more people are making it in than I thought.
Oh,
so, you know,
thanks.
Just throwing it out there.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Okay.
Hey, trust me. I'm a long shot, okay? I readily admit this, okay? If you get in, I'm happy because my odds just jumped. So that's cool.
All right. Well, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, regardless of that, you know, if someone were to describe that to me, I'd probably be like, I don't really know if I want to see that. But it's really freaking good. Like, it's, you know, easily one of the best movies I've seen this year. I'm sure it'll probably make my top 10. Like, I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of movies to still come out this year, but like, I cannot imagine Harry Dean Stanton not getting an Oscar nomination for this thing.
He's a great actor to begin with, but
oh,
sure.
Yeah. And he's basically playing himself, just like a fictionalized version of himself, right? So, I mean, it almost as if like his personality was sort of like transplanted into this character and, you know, interacting with these people and everything. Like, this is sort of like how it would go down. I mean, it's really, really good. And I know it sounds like kind of a downer. it's not at all. It's extremely uplifting. It's very, very funny. There's another one. If someone tells me that a movie is uplifting, I'm like, okay, that means I'm not going to see that. No, it is. Like, I was very much uplifted by it. I left the theater with, like, you know, seeing the world in a different way, you know?
That's awesome.
I mean, it's really, really freaking good, you know? And
I mean, it sounds like a completely different take on things. I mean, we've seen plenty of movies, you know, from a faith-based perspective of a person. You know, I remember the Michael Keaton movie, My Life.
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah. I actually saw a press screening for that one, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, I did. But yeah, no, I mean, it sounds really intriguing just because it's a different perspective than you're used to getting, you know, with that type of film. So yeah, that, you know, I'm sold. I would like to go see this.
Yeah, it's really, really good. And, you know, the screening that I went to, like, it played a few months ago at South by Southwest, and, you know, the reviews coming out of there were stellar. And then, you know, it got picked up for this festival here. And, you know, they did, like, a Q&A afterwards with the writers and the director. The director is, you know, John Carroll Lynch, who's a character actor. One of those guys who is, as soon as you see a picture of him, you're like, oh yeah, that guy who's in all the movies, you know?
Yeah. I gotcha.
And it was written by two people, Logan Sparks and Drago Simonia. I'm sure I'm pronouncing his name wrong, and, you know,
you're in the ballpark at least.
It's
you're definitely in the ballpark.
So that, you know, and they had some really interesting insights into the movie, of course, since they're the ones who made it.
Oh, wow. No, sorry. I just looked up John Carroll Lynch and I just, oh yeah, that guy.
Exactly. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it was his first time directing. You know, I don't think that Sparks and Simonia have written a whole lot, if anything. So it was really kind of cool to see, like, this movie by these first timers starring a guy who's been in, like, 237 movies or something like that, you know?
Conservative estimate.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty awesome. But, you know, I was always, like, really, I mean, the thing that really intrigued me about this, the reason why I, you know, bought a ticket as soon as they went on sale and everything was because of Ira Stephen Bear producing, because that's never something that he's done before in terms of movies. He's never produced a movie. And, you know, I mean, just like we've done on this show and others, like, I always, you know, sort of just in my head daydreaming, do the sort of, like, fantasy crew members of my, you know, fictional movie. Like, if I were to make a movie, I'd get this guy to photograph it or whatever.
Right.
And I've always, for years and years and years, said that, you know, if I were to make a movie, the person who I would get to produce it would be Ira Stephen Bear, because, like, I feel like he's the type of person, like, looking at his television stuff, where, like, he wouldn't let you off the hook, right? Like, if there is a problem with your script or anything to do with your movie, he would tell you flat out that it was garbage and have an idea for how to make it better, right? And I never, like, that, to me, right there, I was always like, I mean, you know, who knows, maybe he's not interested, you know, and it's not his thing, but, like, why wouldn't anyone, like, approach him and be like, hey, you want to produce this thing, just to make sure that, you know, we don't mess it up? And, right. You know, so here it is, first time that he's produced a movie. And, you know, it was really interesting because after the show, they did a Q&A. And of course, I asked about Bear because, I mean, I'm me, you know?
Of course.
So, you know, I asked, like, how he got involved and what his contribution was. And apparently, Simonia is his assistant. Like, he said that he had cast him in a television show, I think he said, in that was shot in Santa Fe. So I'm thinking that's got to be Crash, because I think Crash was shot in New Mexico. I don't know. It doesn't matter. And then after that, Bear asked him to be his assistant when he was working on Alphas. So when these two guys started writing the script or whatever, they wanted to get someone, you know, from the industry who's done this kind of thing before involved to help them out, you know, and help them get it, you know, to the screen. And that's where Bear came in. And as far as, like, what he contributed to it, I mean, Lynch was like, you know, oh man, you know, he, so many things, you know, just throughout, you know, especially like in terms of the script, fixing little problems, adding little things here and there. And one example that he gave was the very last scene in the movie, which I'm not going to tell you what happens in it, but, mm-hmm. you know, he said, and, you know, that they were sitting in, I think, Bear's office or whatever, and Bear's like, it's good, but there's something missing. I can't, you know, I'm almost there. And he said that Bear starts, like, when he's thinking about things like this, he stands up and he starts walking around in circles. And by the way, Lynch does a spot-on Ira Stephen Bear impression for whatever that's worth. And he said that he, you know, kept on thinking about this and then came up with sort of an idea. He says he doesn't even remember what the idea was, but it was something which they were able to give to the writers and say, work with this. And the writers came up with what's, for all practical purposes, the last shot of the movie, which is absolutely perfect. And I mean, it's like it completely caps off like everything that you've seen, you know, wow. up to that point. And it's like that came from not, you know, he didn't write it, but he had that sort of like idea that something needed to be there and was able to like inspire these guys to write it. And I think awesome. That's so cool, you know? But yeah, anyway, Lucky, it comes out in the fall. I'm assuming that it's probably going to play at some festivals, you know, between now and then, because, you know, everyone who sees it loves it. But I highly, highly, highly recommend it. And, you know, as they announce a release date and all that stuff, we'll definitely keep everyone posted. And, you know,
sure.
Hopefully we'll cover it, you know, in depth when it actually comes out. So
no, yeah, I mean, with as effusive as you're being, but it definitely sounds like the type of film that when it does get its release date, move quickly, because it's, you know, it's yeah. not going to get...
It's definitely a smaller yeah. movie, but then again, it's, you know, if it does get the Oscar buzz, which I imagine it could very well get, then it might have some legs. You never know. But yes, definitely go see it as soon as you can. And there are other Star Trek people in it. Ed Begley Jr. has a very small role, and James Darren has a rather large role.
And really?
Yeah, he's pretty. Cool. He's pretty awesome. I'm sure that Bear must have, you know, suggested. I mean, come on.
What? Yeah, that yeah. makes sense.
And there's like a lot of other cool people, like David Lynch is in it. Yeah, he's really good, and you know, very, very funny, and yeah, lots of really good people. Tom Skerritt shows up for one scene, and you're like, what? Oh my God, it's Alien right here.
That's awesome.
All right.
Well, and actually, probably the David Lynch connection, because he directed, Stanton was in a scene of that, what are we talking, that movie about the guy who went.
Well, he was in Straight Story, right?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So they're all, you know, friends. And the other guy, like, you know, the one writer was Bear's assistant. The other writer was Stanton's assistant. So that's how, you know.
Perfect.
So, yeah. But, yes, definitely check it out. Really, really good. I don't mean to go on and on about this movie, which nobody else can see for, like, 3 months, but, you know, or longer than that, 7 months. But, you know, whatever.
We're giving you the hot tip is what we're doing.
There you go. There you go. That's, you know. This is what Stage 9 is all about, giving you the hot right. tips.
Yes.
So speaking of which, last week we gave everyone the hot tip on Orville, and now there's a trailer and a release planned and stills and synopses and character breakdowns and all the rest of it.
And a Twitter account.
And a there's Twitter account. Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, we finally get to sort of like put a face to all the stuff that we've been covering, you know, or did cover last week with the Orville. And yeah, what do you think? What do you think about the trailer and all this stuff?
Yeah, I laughed and I'm looking forward to it. I mean, that, you know, that's it in a nutshell. I mean, I have to give them credit for even getting the lighting of, you know, like a late 80s, early 90s sci-fi show right.
Yeah.
Like it looks right. And you know, there's McFarlane humor in it. You know, no doubt there's a, you know, a discussion about, urination, mistaking a marble for a breath mint. You know, so it has exactly what we kind of suspected, which is silly humor to it. But then of course you see the, I mean, the ship designs are actually pretty darn great.
Well, I just read online that the ships were built by Robert Legato, who is a Star Trek veteran, having won 2 Emmys, for one for Deep Space Nine and one for Next Generation, in addition to 3 Oscars, you know, for Titanic and Jungle Book and stuff.
This is what's so great, and we kind of talked about this last week, though, is like, who's going to know how to tell a Star Trek joke? It's going to be people who worked on Star Trek,
yeah.
And they're going to make the joke work. And what's really refreshing about it is, I know that this will seem silly to say in some sense, but Star Trek at times can take itself a little too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing something where its goal is, in fact, to bring a little levity to it and still sort of mentally function in that environment, I mean, the trailer delivered what I was looking for. So I'm very excited about it, actually.
It's interesting because McFarlane's been talking about it on Twitter all day long, of course, because now he finally can. And one of the things which he said was, we like to think of it as thoughtful sci-fi with a whiskey shot of comedy. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, I don't know. It looks a lot more comedic than he's sort of like letting on. But at the same time, I mean, it definitely seems like they're playing it straight, almost like what we were talking about with Loaded Weapon 1, you know, where,
yeah,
like they get the cinematographer of, you know, all these, you know, like cop movies to shoot it like a cop movie. And then,
right,
you know, you have the joke sort of like sitting on top of it. And I think that that's cool, you know?
Yeah.
Definitely, definitely looking forward to it. So,
yeah, yeah. Same here. Yeah.
And it comes out in the fall. So there you go. On Thursday nights, Thursday nights, I think. Yeah.
Hey, is Fox making a play for must-see TV?
I guess so,
which has,
yeah,
been dead since the 1990s? Possibly.
Maybe. We shall see. So, there's another trailer which debuted at the upfronts this week. I'm not sure,
yeah,
if you watched it or not, and I'm not sure whether or not the listeners have heard about this, but Star Trek Discovery was revealed in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh.
A lot of new info. We're getting an extra 2 episodes, so 15 instead of 13.
That's pretty exciting in and of itself.
Yeah. I'm still wondering whether or not the first episode is 2 hours and counted as 2 episodes or 1 episode.
Who cares? We're getting 2 more hours than we were promised, and that is all that matters. That honestly, that's a vote of confidence in the show. You know, like, we're all familiar with the pulling back on the order for somebody to have seen some part of the product and say, you know what, we want 2 more of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
No, yeah, it is. It is. It's interesting because, you know, one of the things that Fuller said early on was that, you know, given the choice, he would want less episodes, not more.
Interesting.
But, you know. Yeah, so there was that, and then there was a trailer which dropped.
Yes, which caused absolutely no controversy or discussion whatsoever.
Well, I mean, Star Trek rarely does.
Never. There's never a passionate group of fans that pitches battle against each other about look or feel of the show.
No, I mean, because that's just not their thing.
Not at all. Not at all. It's everybody.
I mean,
we're
like,
all one big happy fleet, in the words of one Star Trek creation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at like those Sherlock Holmes fans, the Sherlockians. Is that what they're called? You know,
Holmesians.
I forget. There is a name for them.
I
forget.
I thought we were just having fun. There's actually a name for that fan base.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, okay. But they, you know, they go crazy over the canon, right? You know. I mean, Nicholas Meyer is one of them, right?
Yeah.
Good point. Holmesian expanded universe and everything like that. But Star Trek fans are much more laid back. They're like, whatever, it fits, it doesn't, it's part of the mythology, but it doesn't all need to link together perfectly.
Exactly. They're very laid back about it.
Yeah.
There's no severe knowledge of what was going on 10 years before the first series,
mm-hmm,
or the look of the Klingons. I mean, that's just sort of like a shrug through the years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes Batman wears black and sometimes Batman wears gray and, you know, whatever.
Blue. Sometimes blue.
Blue, yeah.
Hold over from the old 4-color days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, So yes, the trailer, it came out. And yes. What did you think about it?
I'm intrigued. I want to see the show. I thought there were some odd beats in it. There were some odd choices where I was like, it seemed very specifically geared toward the first episode. And I would have expected the trailer to be more, and this is what you can expect from the season sort of thing. It felt more like a trailer for the first episode, which is fine. I mean, honestly, okay, to speak to the Klingons thing, I love the look of the Klingons. I do. And that one main Klingon that they were showing, I know that people are speculating as to, you know, what the character might be or who the character, whatever.
It's T'Kuvma.
Okay, it is T'Kuvma.
Yeah,
okay.
They've said it because they released like a still and they're like, here's T'Kuvma.
Here's what I love about how he looks, right, is the fact that the Klingons are scary to me again. Mm-hmm. The Klingons were the big bad guys and you saw them, but, you know, with Worf and everything and getting to know them through Deep Space Nine and all of that and B'Elanna Torres, you know, the Klingons have had the edge sort of taken off of them. Here's a Klingon that walks on screen and I, you know, whoa, hey, that's terrifying. I'm afraid of you. And I like that in my villains, that sort of thing. But for the other stuff, I thought the visuals looked great. I did spot some lens flares.
There were a lot of lens flares.
Yeah. But I like the way the bridge looked. I like the lighting. I like the aesthetic of everything. I know it's not Nimbus 3. I was hoping it was Nimbus 3. Mm. I'm pretty sure it's Vulcan. But I can dream until the first episode comes out because that would be great. But yeah, no, I really dug it. What did you think?
Yeah, no, I liked it a lot too. You know, it was cool to see like a lot of these things, you know, actually in motion up on screen, you know, characters and sets and, you know, costumes and whatnot, you know. I thought it did look pretty cool. I mean, we've talked about Guillermo Navarro here and seeing his stuff in action. I mean, that definitely did have sort of a Pacific Rim vibe to it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Although the stuff with the Klingons was very reminiscent lighting-wise of some of the stuff in the bar and From Dusk Till Dawn, I thought.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'm playing it back in my head. I could see what you're talking about. Sure, sure.
But, I thought it looked great. And, you know, it was slightly letterboxed, you might have noticed, down to 2:1, which has become, you know, a pretty popular, I guess, aspect ratio amongst television these days. They use it on House of Cards and Fear the Walking Dead and others.
And I know we've touched on this before, but I always forget. Is there a specific reason it's favored? Is it just easier to shoot with? Is it just something where it just came into vogue and everybody started doing it?
I think people just like the way it looks, you know?
Okay.
It's slightly more cinematic. I don't know. We have to ask David Fincher. I think he's the one who's mainly to blame. It's interesting because, I mean, in a lot of ways it is kind of goofy. Like, it goes back to the whole, like, Russell Mulcahy music video thing. Where, like, music videos started being letterboxed, and he's like...
Well, that would make sense then, because that was Fincher's start, was music videos.
Yeah, music videos, yeah. I mean, Mulcahy, you know, his whole thing, he was like, you know, we had no money, you know, we were shooting these things, you know, very, very cheaply. You put black bars in the top and bottom, you know, make it widescreen, instantly it adds, like, a ton of production value because it looks more cinematic, you know?
Yeah.
It's an easy trick. And I mean, that's like literally what they would be doing here, I'm assuming, unless they were shooting some sort of weird anamorphic format. But the ratio, though, 2:1 is something which was very much championed by Vittorio Storaro, the cinematographer of things like Apocalypse Now and Tucker, A Man in His Dream, and, you know, all these other things. He developed it. He called it like Univision or something like that. And his idea was like, you got movies which are 1.85 and you got movies which are 2.39. Let's find something nice in between. But he's also like, this is perfectly balanced for like the spacing between the eyeballs and whatever. He was a really big fan. You know, also, you know, probably a little eccentric, but, you know, whatever. I mean, you have to be if you're going to work with Francis Ford Coppola,
yes.
I imagine. But yeah, so that's, you know, kind of cool to see that, you know, something a little unique, you know, a little cinematic. Yeah.
Was there anything in the trailer that you didn't like? Was there anything that you were like, eh, like not disliked per se, but you considered a choice where you were like, oh, that's kind of weird?
Not tremendously. I mean, certainly, like if I were making the show, I would, you know, make certain choices on an aesthetic level, which kind of lined up with the pre-established continuity. I'm not saying that I'd pull like a Star Trek, you know, Continues or a Star Trek New Voyages and make it look like it was something out of the 60s. But at the same time, like, we've seen the uniforms from this era, and I would probably do like what JJ did, where, you know, you modify basically the old uniforms, the old look of the, you know, those uniforms into something modern yet still sort of like just an update of what we had seen before.
But see, here's the thing with also the Klingons that I would hope they would embrace. I have no idea. This is speculation on my part. I won't be disappointed if they don't do this. But for me, it always offers the intriguing possibility that Discovery's mission is different, and therefore its uniforms are different. There's a very specific reason why their uniforms are different. Or, you know, I mean, because you go back to the old show and the, you know, the Arrowhead had different stuff in it for, you know, the different commanders and stuff. You know, like there are differences even back then. So you could easily explain away as, well, you know, Discovery was on a very specific, you know, type of, it was a certain type of vessel, and therefore we wanted them to have this or something like that. And why do the Klingons look a little bit different? Well, you know, one of the things that always drives me nuts is who says that the Klingons are, you know, all look exactly the same, you know, like even human beings don't. Like, these are Klingons from a different quadrant, or these are Klingons from a different part of the planet, or why not? You know, that's fine by me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. The look of the Klingons has changed so much over time that, you know, it's like another slight modification, you know, who really cares, you know?
But I mean, you know, with the uniforms, they're on a different mission, or they're going to a different part of the, you know, that they're on an ambassadorial mission. And so they wanted to do something, you know, truly unique, or they had to look different for some reason. You know, if it needs an explanation, I'm sure that these very talented writers will have it somewhere in the show, knowing the audience that they're dealing with.
Yeah, yeah. I'm guessing that it won't have an explanation. You know, I mean, there's, you know, some stuff which has been, like the use of the Delta, you know, shield or whatever. Like, that doesn't make any sense in terms of the continuity and that sort of thing. But it's like iconic, you know, you gotta have it.
Sure.
Almost, you know, it's, you're almost contractually obligated, or maybe you are contractually obligated to include that in the show, you know. But, you know, whatever. I mean, it's not like I'm gonna be like, oh, these uniforms are terrible, I'm not watching this show, you know. It's just I'm just saying, like, if I were to produce the show, I would probably not do that. But then again, you know, I'd also probably set it in the Kelvin timeline. You know, I mean, there's lots of things that I would do.
I really liked the spacesuit. I can say that. I thought the spacesuit was really nifty looking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I thought it looked cool. You know, I liked the bridge being on like the bottom of the saucer, you know, of what looks like Discovery and stuff.
Yeah,
but, you know, there were some interesting things in there, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, we were talking about this a lot off mic, and, you know, after I watched it, like an hour or two after I watched it, I was like, you know, watched it a couple times, and I'm like, wait a minute, is she supposed to be Vulcan? Because I'm really slow, you know, as far as these things are concerned. I'm like, oh, look, she's... because she's got the haircut when she's like a kid, it looks like, and then there's a dissolve to her. Because
it looks like
you
she's
know,
got the ears too.
What was that?
It looks like the kid has the ears too.
Does it? See, I didn't see that
for a split second. Maybe I'm jumbling up the sequence of images or something like that. But my impression, looking at it, seeing the kid and hearing, you know, your human tongue will never be able to form the Vulcan words or language, whichever, whatever it was. Forgive me if I'm butchering the line, but words to that effect, and seeing her on the medical bed, my actual first thought was that there is somebody who is seeking their identity in a specific way, and maybe is, you know, in the midst of the process in some way.
I mean,
in terms of deciding that,
you know, that's an interesting concept. I mean, because like when you first said that to me, I was like, oh, like that makes a lot of sense because, like, and I don't even remember what it was they said, but like, what was it, a year or 2 years ago when Rod Roddenberry and right. Trevor Roth were at, you know, Vegas, like, I remember hearing them talk, and there was not one, but two things that they said where they seemed to be strongly implying that there was going to be, like, a trans character or, like, some sort of, you know, let's say, like, proxy for that since it's Star Trek and, you know, they're always, right. you know, dealing with, you know, issues today in, you know, sort of an abstract science fiction way. And that's really the impression that I got. Right. I don't even remember what it is that they said. But, you know, so when you said that, I'm like, oh, yeah, that maybe that's what it is. But then when I started, like, thinking about it more logically and everything, I'm like, I don't really know if that necessarily makes sense with everything else that we know.
I for me, that was the very first viewing of the trailer. That was the impression that I got.
Interesting.
That Senequa Martin Green's character, so many different permutations you could go with. Is she a Vulcan who is part human and wants to try being human? Is she the Vulcans? Are the Vulcans making her look more human to serve on the Discovery for some reason? Are they, you know, is she a human who wanted to become Vulcan and couldn't manage it? You know, and the Vulcans rejected her, and she goes back, and that's where we find her in the timeline. But I just got a very, very strong impression from the trailer that her identity is going to become a very big thing in terms of the storyline.
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, they even say that in the like the synopsis, where it's like, you know,
yeah.
before you can, you know, go off and explore the galaxy, you have to figure out who you are, or something along those lines. I forget exactly what it says in the yeah. press release, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, at first I was like, oh, she's part Vulcan, like she's, you know, half Vulcan or quarter Vulcan or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not necessarily convinced of that now either, because there's the whole thing with Spock being the first Vulcan in Starfleet and all that stuff, you know.
No, he was the first Vulcan that went full ride through the academy or something. Like, they could skirt that easily by saying that she was put into Starfleet but never commissioned or something like that.
I mean, they could do that in any millions of ways that they have done in the past. Sure, you know, I mean, that's true. I mean,
did Spock have a brother?
They've already
until Star Trek V.
they've already, you know, I mean, the original idea was that Spock was the only alien in Starfleet, I think, right? They've obviously just said, like, screw that. We're not even going to try to explain that anymore because, you know, whatever. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting. Like, what I do take away from it, though, you know, which, you know, when I started thinking about, like, her being, you know, Vulcan, or at least being a human who's maybe trying to emulate
right.
the Vulcan lifestyle, I guess, I started thinking about the origins of this character, you know, as Fuller described them, you know, a long time ago now at this point. And he was talking about how at one point they were actually considering making this the same character that Majel Barrett plays, number one, in The Cage. And yeah. I started thinking about that and how that character was originally basically personality-wise a Vulcan, right? I mean, she mm-hmm. was what Spock would become, right? They essentially, yes. like, fused those two characters together.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's an interesting retcon. If, like, maybe she acts that way because she was raised by Vulcans or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I mean, even back then, I was like, wait a minute, but if she's the first officer on this other ship, you know, she was the first officer on, you know. And you know, in here, you know, it looks like she starts off as the first officer on the Shenzhou. So if you think about it, like, plot-wise, initially maybe she was going to start off as the first officer on Enterprise and then transfer to Discovery. And now they're, you know, when they decided to make it its own character.
You know what? It's interesting, though. What you just said right there actually triggers something else. Maybe there's some sort of, you know, she was a refugee, orphan, what have you. And the Vulcans took her in,
mm-hmm.
right? And so she, you know, grew up with them, like you said. But now, and it sort of is a mirror, but different from Spock, because Spock is trying to be Vulcan and trying to, you know, disavow his humanity for a lot of it and come to grips with it. What if this is a character who the Vulcans have said, listen, we've tried to raise you, but you got to go find out what being human's about, and send her out there. And that's like her whole thing, is she has to find out what it means to be human the way Spock would.
And that would kind of make sense, because if you think about like early Sarek, you know, and I mean, this is the earliest we've ever seen Sarek, not counting the vision in
the
Star
flashback
Trek 5,
to,
which
yes.
may or may not be. I mean, to me, that's just Spock's nightmare. That's not actually something that happened.
Right. I wouldn't imagine that Spock has a memory of it.
Mm-hmm.
Although I remember reading something at some point that Vulcans did remember
no,
their
that,
birth.
Okay. You might have read that somewhere. I'm calling BS on that right now.
Oh, I'm fine with that being called BS on. Please, listen, I'm old enough that I remember back at the old role-playing game explained away the forehead ridges, as you had human fusion Klingons and Imperial Klingons, and that was the difference.
Yeah.
And probably that's why I have a vestige in my brain of like, there can be different versions of Klingon, that's okay. That's probably, you know, what's hanging on in my brain.
Anyway, yeah. Regardless of any of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my point here is that Sarek, based on seeing his relationship with Spock early on, like in Journey to Babel and everything like that,
yeah,
like he's kind of prejudiced towards humans, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and that's a theme that they ran with in Enterprise as well. So mm-hmm. that would fit into the continuity just fine of like, ugh, humans.
Right. So it's interesting, but I mean, like looking at it, like, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I noticed for whatever reason was her hairstyle, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's short, you know, short, straight, rather Vulcan, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, there's some shots, which maybe it's just the angle or whatever, where her eyebrows look a little bit pointy, you know? And then you look at like the key art and everything, where there's they got like Vulcan, you know, hand symbols all over the place and all that stuff. I mean, there's definitely something going on with her being, you know, Spock-like, but maybe from the other side of it, you know, a human trying to be a Vulcan, or, you know, or,
yeah.
or something. I don't know. It's
right, a human who's grappling with what it means to be human, and so they're in search of, you know, being a Vulcan, and or you know, and the Vulcans are like, no, you got to go try being, you know, yes. All of that, I think, lines up, and I think it would definitely line up, like you said, with the idea of what Star Trek does, which is treating contemporary issues in a fictional way and,
right.
you know, giving you a different way to deal with it in your brain to figure out how what you think about
yeah.
what's going on in the world.
It's by no means like a one-to-one correlation, you know?
Right.
But it's thematically consistent, perhaps, you know?
Yeah.
And that's cool. I mean, that's what Star Trek does, you know? That was kind of like its mission statement, you know, from the beginning. So that's cool. And I'm sure that, you know, assuming that they do, you know, deal with these issues, they will deal with them in a much more eloquent way than than we have pondered here today, you know?
You know, we've done the best that we can speculating, you know, so,
which, you know, yeah. I mean, God, you know, I'm so sort of like ashamed and embarrassed for having, you know, dissected this 2-minute trailer.
No, no, do not. You know why? Because how often do we get something on screen to dissect?
I guess so. Yeah.
For Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm very serious. The last time we could pull something apart was a Star Trek Beyond trailer.
Yeah.
Right? Which was contentious enough to begin with. And then we come up to this one. I got to be honest, I'm just happy to have a reason to talk about Star Trek
again.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
Like some fresh Star Trek. That's good.
No, that's true. That's true. I guess, you know, whatever. I mean, I just know anytime someone says, like, do you think Snoke is this? I'm like, shut up. Just stop talking, please. You know,
Snoke is a Vulcan.
Right.
Okay?
There you go.
We
that's
it for
what
you.
I was thinking is, you know, yeah. Sonequa Martin Green is Snoke. So we'll see how that plays out. But yeah, you know, All right. Well, should we jump into our feature presentation for today?
Let's jump into that feature presentation. Let's fall into it, Mike.
All right. From the sky. Skyfall, yes. The James Bond movie, which was co-written by John Logan along with Neil Purvis and Robert Wade. This was the third Daniel Craig movie.
Yes.
It was directed by Sam Mendes, who would go on to direct Spectre, as well as, you know, direct a whole bunch of other really, really, really good things, like yes. American Beauty and Road to Perdition and Away We Go and those things. And, yeah, it's, should note, edited by Stuart Baird.
Yep.
Which is really yep. interesting because, you know, Nemesis was written by John Logan and directed by Stuart Baird. So it's mm-hmm. kind of a re-teaming, only instead of directing, Baird is editing. And we'll get into that in a little bit, I'm sure. But, yeah, would you want to give a synopsis of Skyfall for those who haven't seen it?
Wow. Yeah, it's a James Bond movie where he... Something goes wrong in the beginning, and then he has to come back to MI6 in a time of need. But it is really the first Bond movie that really addressed sort of the Star Trek II angle of... I mean, there have been references through Bond movie history of, you're a dinosaur, your ways belong to the past. You know, like sort of those winks and nods of like, you know, hey, Sean Connery's way of doing things isn't really cool anymore. But this is the first one that really deals, I think, with that sort of like existentialist thought of the aging agent. So, you know, sort of like the Kirk angle. So that's really what the movie is about, is Bond seeking proof that he still belongs in this world. And of course, you know, the whole movie addresses that as well about, you know, because there's this whole debate going on about, does an agent like James Bond still belong in a world dominated by computers and hacking? And is that, you know, and so the whole movie is about that thematically, but through it, of course, there is a main villain who is obsessed with taking apart MI6 and killing Bond along the way.
Of course, of course. It's interesting that you mentioned the parallels between this and Wrath of Khan, because people are very fond of mentioning the parallels between Nemesis and Wrath of Khan, which are a bit more on the nose and perhaps a bit less effective, maybe because they're so on the nose. And I guess that's a good question, is do you think that this is a better riff on Wrath of Khan than Nemesis is?
Yes.
I guess that's kind of a softball. Yeah,
it's one of those things because it's true to the themes that you find without trying to parrot the story beats.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, I'm presuming you feel the same way.
Yeah, I do. You know, I mean, it's interesting because this is, I think this was like the 50th anniversary Bond movie,
yes.
right? I know.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of sort of like nods and winks and, you know, trying to, you know, commemorate, you know, the history of the franchise and all that stuff. And I think that they did a really good job with that by acknowledging the past in ways that sort of reinforced the present, you know? I mean...
And that also served the plot.
Yes, yes. I mean, like the thing that they did with the Goldfinger car, the Aston Martin, I thought was so amazing. Like, that's like my absolute favorite moment in the movie, maybe in the franchise, because you see the car there and you're like, oh, yeah, history, right? But then, like, it's got all of the gadgets which are inside of the car from Goldfinger, and it makes sense why they would be there. Because we'd seen the car back in Casino Royale when he won it in that poker game.
Mm-hmm.
And since getting it, he's like, let me, you know, pimp my ride and, you know, make this into, you know, a Bond car, really.
Right.
And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. You know, I mean, finding like a workable in-universe explanation for this relic's existence, you know?
And I think it also, if I'm not mistaken, it's the first time you get the full James Bond theme in the film. is when they get in that car and drive off, because that's the moment where Bond takes control and says, we're leading now. We're not following. And it's like, that's a great, an amazing moment.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying there, that's the one thing about the movie, which I'm kind of like, I mean, I can't fault it because the movie works so well on its own, but it's very similar actually to the Star Trek reboots in a sense, where like in the first movie, Casino Royale, it's basically like you don't start with the theme or anything like that. You don't start with the gun barrel sequence or all that whatever, because like Bond isn't Bond yet. You know, it's an origin story, and he's like going through, you know, what he needs to go through in order to become the character which we have known all of these years. And at the end of the movie, after going through all of this stuff, and he goes to, you know, pick off the one guy, you know, and he's like standing over him, and he says, the name's Bond, James Bond. And then the theme kicks in. It's like, okay, there it is. He's earned it. He is now James Bond, right?
Right.
Well, then, you know, they kind of like kept that formula for Quantum of Solace. And then with Skyfall, you know, I felt like they were kind of like going through all of the motions of like trying to get the pieces in place for him to once again become the Bond that we all know and love. You know, they introduce Q, they introduce Moneypenny, you know, M is, you know, much more sort of like in keeping with the original M.
But they reboot all of those characters along the way.
They do, but I mean, like, it feels like another origin story, right?
I don't agree with that. I think that the way that the film starts works specifically because I think even before, you know, the thing that happens right before we'll have a few spoilers in here. If you haven't seen Skyfall by this point, I mean, come on. Before he gets shot and you know, when Adele's Oscar-winning song starts, you see him already having sort of like doubts about things because he's going through and, you know, M is telling him, leave him. And he's like, no, he's actually trying to save the fellow agent. And M is basically saying, no, screw him. You got to go do this job. And then she orders the shot. So I think that there's a sense of unease about it where you immediately get this feel of Bond not completely comfortable with what's going on at this point. And so I think that serves it very well, because that would explain why, after surviving being shot and falling in the river and, you know, going over a waterfall and everything, he'd be like, screw this. No, I'm going off. I'm getting drunk all the time now, which honestly, you know, or, you know, that's cool by me. That works for me. But,
you know, I think maybe it's not so much the character, you know, the arc that the character has, as it is sort of like, the sort of like meta thing which is going on in terms of, you know, like getting all of the pieces in place to make like a Bond movie that we all know and love. Whereas with Star Trek, I think it is much more sort of like character oriented in that sense, where, you know, Star Trek 09 does exactly the same thing that Casino Royale does, you know, much more sort of literally, where it's like getting all of the pieces in place to become that thing that we know the original series to be. And again, it ends with that opening theme song, and it's like, okay, we're here. Great. Cool. Now we can go on these adventures. Now we can go on our 5-year mission. And then Into Darkness starts, and it's like, okay, so now, you know, we're going to go through this thing, and it's going to get us to a place where we can go on our 5-year mission. And it's like, wasn't that what the whole last movie was about? I don't.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. I think that most likely the real remnant of it is that by this point, you know, with this, I have not seen Quantum of Solace, but you say it ends with the gun barrel thing. It doesn't open with it, right?
Yeah,
that's Quantum of Solace. I've actually steered clear of. It's the only Bond movie I haven't seen at this point.
That's
because even diehard
weird
Bond fans have been telling me. It just keeps falling to the bottom of the queue. Like, I keep having other stuff to watch, so I'm just like, yeah, I'll get around to it. I felt no urgency with Quantum of Solace. It is the one and only Bond movie in existence that I have not watched.
You weren't even like, oh, Skyfall's coming out. I hear there's like a continuing storyline. I guess I better.
Nope. I had given up on Bond by the time Skyfall came out. I liked Casino Royale. Quantum of Solace got bad reviews, and I was never a huge Bond guy. And, you know, I'd seen some Bond movies. I hadn't seen them all up to that point. I like Casino Royale. But Bond has a history of, you know, if you're lucky, good movie, yeah, not so good movie. But typically it's been like up, down, up. Like it's like a little, like just absolutely erratic heartbeat sort of thing in terms of quality of the films. And so I had tapped out by that point. I didn't see Skyfall in the theater either. And eventually... it was, you know what? I want to credit, Sean with my friend Sean with being the one to say, no, you got to watch Skyfall. I was like, okay, fine. I'll watch Skyfall. And I watched it and I sent him, we were working together at the time. I went in the following morning. Yeah. I would have gone in the following morning, either sent him an email or something like that and said, I want to know more. I want to become a Bond fan now. Like Skyfall is the movie that turned me into a Bond fan. And I still haven't seen Quantum of Solace because every single Bond fan I've ever talked to, that is the only one that they persistently just kick. They just beat it up.
Okay, well, I'm, you know, I hate to be that guy, but...
oh, no, Mike, I think I expect you to be that guy.
Okay, you know, Quantum of Solace is not a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination. You know, people like to kick it because I think it's not Casino Royale, and it's not Skyfall either, you know what I mean? But, like, coming off of Casino Royale, I mean, I think it was really interesting for them to do something which they'd never really done before, which is to say, like, okay, this is... the next chapter. Like, it's not just, you know, like another adventure. Like, this is literally like continuing the story. Like, I mean, so much so that, you know, it picks up minutes after Casino Royale ends.
Mm-hmm.
They're all wearing, you know, different clothes because the you know, suit contract went to Tom Ford, but, you know, whatever, we can give that. But, you know, I mean, it is, you know, like literally like, you know, just it picks up right where the other one left off. And, you know, I mean, yeah, there's some stupid stuff in there. You can say that it gets to be a bit formulaic. You can say the whole thing that happens at the end is a little, you know, cliche and stupid that, you know, something like this would even exist or whatever and all that stuff. But there's some really good stuff in there too. And I think on the whole, it's really cool to see how, you know, the story builds and how the character builds, you know, from one movie to the next, and then, you know, leading into Skyfall in a lot of ways, and then they really pick up a lot of, you know, threads in Spectre. And I don't know. I mean, I think that sort of, like, style of storytelling is a lot better than, you know, a lot of the stuff that had been going on in the Bond films, because, like you're saying, I mean, there's some great ones and then there's some terrible ones, and then they really do fluctuate, you know, throughout time. And I mean,
but see, here's the difficult thing is, now that we're in the serious Bond time, maybe this is what has kept me away from Quantum of Solace and hearing people beat up on it, is when Roger Moore movies went wrong, it becomes like a Mystery Science Theater sort of thing. Like, you can enjoy how bad it is. Diamonds Are Forever, it'll put you to sleep by the end of it, but when you're watching it and you just watch that sequence where they basically say that the moon landings were faked and you just can't believe that they did that, you know, that's the sort of thing that if you're dealing with serious Bond and it's not good, that's a drag. Like, you know, what has always saved Bond is, I mean, first and foremost, the fact that it existed in the time before, you know, video, so people couldn't watch the same movie, you know, 1,000 times before the sequel came out. But now I feel bad about staying away from Quantum of Solace, so maybe I will watch it now.
I would definitely recommend it. It's not great. It's not as good as these other ones, but it's definitely...
It can't possibly be as bad as Die Another Day.
No, it's not nearly as bad as Die Another Day. It's better than most Bond movies, okay? Okay. It really is. It's better than every single Roger Moore Bond. It's better than, you know, every single Timothy Dalton.
Now, hold on there. Spy Who Loved Me? Come on.
I never liked Spy Who Loved Me. I know, whatever.
Dead to me.
The only Roger Moore Bond which I think is decent is For Your Eyes Only.
Oh, that's crazy talk. That's no way. No way. For Your Eyes Only isn't bad, but it's no Spy Who Loved Me. Come on, man. Anyway. None of those were shot by Roger Deakins.
This is true. You know, and, oh my God. You know, I mean, people always debate film versus digital. What's better? Oh, film. I mean, like even Spectre, the very next movie was shot on film. This is the only Bond movie which was shot digitally. But I mean, you look at this and you're like, when someone's trying to make a digital movie look as good as it possibly can, and they're playing to the format's strengths instead of just trying to make it look like film, which it never can, you get Skyfall, and it looks gorgeous. And I, you know, looking at this movie, like, I mean, maybe this makes me a bad person, you know, whatever. This opinion's probably even less popular than saying that Quantum of Solace is good. But, you know, I think in some ways, if done appropriately, digital is better than film.
All I care about is how it looks. I don't care how you shoot it.
And this looks amazing.
Right. It is. This is, I've been saying this ever since I rewatched it. Like, it's so gorgeous that, While I was rewatching it this time, I wanted to just shout at the television, stop being so perfect. Like, it's just that, like, it makes you angry that something can be this good, because it reminds you of things that you do that aren't as good. Mm. But it is, I mean, I still remember the first time I watched it, when it got to the Shanghai scene where he's in the all glass with the lights and everything, and he's stalking the guy who's gonna take the sniper shot, and then that fight that they have where they're just in shadow. Like, it's so mind-blowing how amazing that looks. Or the fact that, you know, when they were in the house at Skyfall, and you know, you have the orange light, and the orange light is managing just to highlight, like, it looks almost like a living comic book. Mm-hmm. Because there's this wash on the background that's all blue gray, and then the people themselves have light and they're orange, and it literally looks like an old four color comic book, only amazing and true to life. Like, it's just, it is so wonderful. And actually seeing like a behind the scenes shot of how they pulled off, you know, the burning house without actually burning a house down. Mm-hmm. And while people were walking around, and seeing the light set up and everything like that is just, it's just downright amazing. I have to ask, because I didn't look, but did they win an Oscar for that, for the cinematography in this? Because if not, I don't know what's wrong with the world.
Yeah, no, they didn't.
That's insane.
I don't know what won that year, but
That's just nuts. And as for the editing, right? Like, you go through and it's a little over 2.5 hours. Not a minute was I bored, was I distracted, was anything like that. And then I have to say, you know, because the whole wellspring of this is, you know, John Logan working on Nemesis. Okay, we've looked at Any Given Sunday, and now we've looked at Skyfall. There is a consistency here where John Logan's been involved in them, and he's also been involved in Nemesis. Nemesis is not as well regarded as a Star Trek film can be. So, you know, it's one of those things where with these three bits of data, Logan wasn't the problem. It wasn't his script that went wrong with Nemesis. Like, I think just taking these two, you know, leave out everything else he did, hands down, he definitely was not the problem with Nemesis at all.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you've got Stuart Baird directing Nemesis and then, you know, editing this. And you know, like you're saying, the editing and this is really good and everything. And it is really good. And that's sort of like this weird thing where Stuart Baird is one of the best editors in the world, right? I mean, he edited Superman the movie, you know, he's done a million things. And, you know, as sort of, you know, a reward, I guess you could say, for, you know, his work as an editor, you know, he gets to direct movies, and that's something which he maybe isn't as good at. And, you know, I don't like he's I think Nemesis was probably the last movie that he directed. You know, since then he's gone back to editing, and I think that that's perfectly reasonable for someone to do. You know, I don't really see that as like failure or whatever. I mean, this is something that, you know, Nick Meyer would always talk about, you know, when he was writing Wrath of Khan, you know, and the idea of like Kirk being promoted to admiral, and it's like, you're so good at your job that, you know, we're going to give you a promotion where you're going to do something which you're not at all good at, you know? It's right. Like, no, let the person do that thing that he's really good at, you know, or she. And, you know, I think that it's kind of too bad that, you know, lots of times the way these things are set up, it's just, you know, almost necessary for people to have to do that just because of money. Like,
but couldn't you make the argument that by the time Nemesis rolls around, there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and it's a franchise, and it's an old franchise, and yeah, they were looking to try to breathe new life into it and those sorts of things, but you still have maybe the issue there was that you had people that their true strength is when they're allowed to do their thing. Like Skyfall is a Bond movie, but it's not what you it wasn't what you thought of as a Bond movie. Like Skyfall was mind-blowing because you watch it after seeing all of the Bond stuff, and I mean, you know, in my case, it made me a go out and become a Bond fan. But you watch Skyfall after, you know, all of the Bond movies leading up to it, and it's almost like I can't what's different? Why was this so different, so much better? And I think it's because you have two options with a franchise. You can either try to hammer it in and make these people fit in that mold, or you can say, go nuts, do what you want. And, you know, so long as you don't, you know, blow everything up, you know, we can make this work. And I think that's why Skyfall winds up excelling on every possible level.
Yeah. And hey, Stuart Baird, he edited this. He also edited Casino Royale. That means he edited the two best Bond films of all time, according to me. So
it's an important qualifier at the end there.
You know, I mean, that's pretty amazing. So, yeah. All right. Well, I mean, I think we're both in agreement. Check out Skyfall.
If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. Definitely in HD. Make a point to see it in HD.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's been fun talking about Skyfall today, but that isn't the only thing we're talking about this week on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And Jim Carrey, as they're fighting, he's like singing along. He's like, brah, brah. As he's fighting, he's singing along as he's fighting Matthew Broderick. And man, it's just so good. Like, to me, that's like, when I think of Star Trek and pop culture, like, that is the one, that's the first scene that I think of in the Cable Guy there.
Warp 5.
They never really do say what sport it is, right? We just assume it's baseball because he said doubleheader.
Well, he went to a baseball game with Herd, and he said baseball.
I think he said baseball in Doylestown earlier. So.
Yeah.
Oh, well. All right. Well, sorry, writers. You messed that one up then.
This is too, I don't even want to do this commentary anymore. Let's switch it to something else.
My whole life is a lie.
The 602 Club.
That's one thing I was very surprised about this book, is that when he does whatever mission it is that he's on, which maybe destroying a mind or something, or destroying even a ship, that he is doing everything he can to make sure no one is losing a life during this. That he's trying to do it in a way that people are not going to die, or at least a mass amount of people aren't going to die. And you would think, when you think of the Empire, it's like, they don't care.
The Ready Room.
This is Lieutenant Stamets, a science officer specializing in astromycology, which is the study of fungi in space.
Fungi in space!
Yes, exactly. And I'm picturing the ship looks like a giant fungus.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll discover us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to contact us about, Skyfall, let us know what you think. The best place to join in a larger conversation would be the Babel Conference, which is our listener group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook and we'll come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website or go to trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Stage 9, and that'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, well, you can look for Kessel Junkie. You can also go over and find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, General Format Show. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing, where we talk about Star Wars stuff. And you can also find me on the Nerd Party talking about Star Wars creators on a show called Great Shot Kid with a charming, charming man named Mike Schindler.
Yeah, we're over there doing the same thing that we do over here. And I'm also on TalkFilmSociety.com doing a show called Soderbergh 2828, where we look at all of Steven Soderbergh's movies over the span of his 28-year career. And you can find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing my own show, Commentary Track Stars, where we talk about basically whatever we want, do a lot of audio commentaries and other things. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Chris Steftenagel and Jeff Sutter. Thanks a lot, guys. We really appreciate it. If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right, well, that wraps up a look at John Logan tackling one beloved franchise. And next week, we're going to be all timely and take a look at John Logan's interpretation of another beloved franchise, this time the Alien franchise, with the brand spanking new Ridley Scott movie, Alien Covenant.